This morning, we take a look at DATA, Data for Democracy, a volunteer collective of data scientists that emerged in the wake of the Trump administration. And as we are now living in an age of alternative facts, it seems that we need their efforts more than ever. We have a member of the Boulder chapter of Data for Democracy joining us in the studio, Sam Zhang. And joining us by phone, we have the national co-founder, Jonathan Morgan. Welcome to you both. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Well,
yeah, thanks for having me.
Sam, you were a guest on Resistance Radio earlier in the summer several weeks ago, but we're going to broaden the discussion and talk a little bit more about what's happening nationally. Jonathan, tell us a little bit about your background and what prompted you to co-found this organization.
So my background's mostly in technology. I've been working as a software engineer and a data scientist, focused a lot on building things that help people communicate with each other, and then got into research looking at how different communities were being manipulated, frankly, using those same tools or same platforms that at some point I'd participated in constructing. And so it seemed like there was a moment where the tech community and the data science community needed to pull together, kind of find its values, and really participate in the way that all of these technologies that we've been building for so long were shaping the society that we lived in. And so it seemed about the right time to stand something up, build an organization, and see if we could bring some folks together.
Could give us an example of, you say that you saw communities being manipulated by some of these platforms that you were helping build. What do you mean by that? What was happening?
Well, this goes back kind of a long way, actually. So in 2012, 2013, a lot of my personal research was focused on how extremist organizations like ISIS in particular were using, kind of gaming the mechanics of social media to increase their profile on these platforms, to sort of elevate them into mainstream conversation. So you'd see a hashtag that was popular because of the World Cup in Brazil suddenly being filled with content that was focused on ISIS propaganda, or you'd see 40,000 accounts had all provided their credentials, or so they logged in with some application that some central application could send messages through kind of all of these different 40,000 accounts, which made it seem as if there was some kind of groundswell of popular support for content, and it would push it into Twitter's, you know, trending algorithms and things like that. But this is the same kind of thing that we've seen subsequently over the next, you know, over the following 3 or 4 years, where any type of special interest group, whether they wanted to support one, in I guess most recently, because there was a intense support of one of the candidates over the other in the 2016 presidential race, that there was a real push to use these tactics to kind of manufacture social consensus, manufacture the idea that some things were true when they in fact probably weren't. And I think we're all used to the idea now of, you know, fake news and social media bots and things like that. But these tactics have been around for a while, and I think we're just starting to see the ways in which they can shape democracy and kind of shape our public discourse if we're not careful.
Well, how does Data for Democracy then, as a collective, how does that counteract some of those trends?
I think in two really important ways. So one is that there are researchers in the community who are focused on just this problem, focused on understanding social media data and social media manipulation, writing about the ways in which sort of an army of bots were trying to influence the outcome of the French election, kind of doing retrospectives, looking at how automated accounts are still trying to influence public discourse in mainstream political spaces in U.S. politics. But I think maybe one level back from that I think is even more important, and this is sort of directly related to the kind of work that Sam is doing, and all of the other volunteers that have stood up local chapters around the country, people that are rallying folks online, is just to get involved. I think there's a sense of sort of civic responsibility that's been missing from the tech industry for a long time. And I think what's really exciting and what's really inspiring for me about the work that folks do in Data for Democracy is that they're bringing that sense of civic engagement to the tech community, and they're making it core to their, you know, kind of core to the values of their organizations that they're with. When they're not volunteering, they're making it core to the values of the institutions where they're, you know, learning as students. And they're really bringing a sense of sort of shared ownership of society's problems, and using data science and technology to at least make a dent in and the things that are affecting our communities. So I think that just that sense of responsibility will inevitably lead to smarter choices in the way that we build these platforms and manage public discourse going forward, given that technology is so central to that process.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more in a few minutes about that issue of responsibilities and where it lies with individual tech people, but also the large tech giants that are also being identified as having a big role to play in this. But I would like to bring in our guest in studio, Sam Zhang, who is part of the Boulder chapter of the Data for Democracy. And Sam, we spoke to you earlier this year about a project that you were working on, mining some data that had been released by Stanford University in terms of racial profiling when it comes to police arrests. Remind our listeners is exactly what that project was.
That's right. There was a project out of a collaboration between the Stanford Journalism School and engineering to do records requests in every state across the country for state police department stops, traffic stops. And they sort of standardized the format of these record requests or of the responses and released it to the public in a way that communities could perform sort of like local journalism on their area. And I was sort of surprised to see that nobody else had really done that in their area yet. Stanford did something in Oakland, but that was the only other news I could find about it. And so another member of the local chapter, Jeff, and I looked at the state police stops in sort of the Denver Boulder area, and we shot off an email to you and came on the air.
Well, remind our listeners what you found, and we do have the graphs that you created that you created as a result of digging into this data, and that's at news.kgnu.org. Just look for Data for Democracy. But you did find some interesting local results.
Yeah, it wasn't surprising to me given the national results. We fit the template perfectly. We essentially found that Latino folks, when they get stopped, tend to get arrests rather than citations more often. And when they're searched, contraband is found less often than white folks. And the details of it are on the website. And we sort of, you know, we're just right there and sort of averagely bad among all the communities around the country. But I want to remind everyone that that's not our local police, that's the state police. There's some evidence that the local police has a similar tendency. The city contracted with an agency to do a audit last year, and they reported something along those lines, except that they lacked the sufficient data to really make a good judgment.
And that brings us back to the need for having data. And I want to remind our listeners, we're talking about data this morning, but trying to find out how it relates to our democracy. And in fact, Data for Democracy is the name of the organization that's our guest today. We have the co-founder of the National Group joining us on the phone, Jonathan Morgan. And in studio, we have Sam Zhang, who is part of the Boulder chapter. And chapters have emerged all around the country. And they're a group of volunteer data scientists who just want to dig in to information. Sam, that particular project was available to you because Stanford released some data. When we talk about data, we're looking at statistics, we're looking at information that is either out there available to the public or needs to be requested. And so what other projects could you potentially be looking at in Boulder? And what's on your wish list of the things that you'd like to be doing?
Well, that project sort of kicked off another sort of police accountability project with a friend and neighbor, Darren O'Connor, who started a group around here called Boulder Rights Watch. And he performs a lot of advocacy for tenants' rights and the homeless in particular. Darren had done a few records requests to Boulder County Jail in a few points in time in the past and seen the proportion of the jail bookings that were of homeless people and the sort of charges that they tend to get booked for, which tend to be things like camping ban, smoking ban, and these other sort of relatively innocuous charges that some folks insist are not used to police the homeless. So we decided to sort of take that at the level of data analysis and do a records request with the sheriff's office for all of the jail bookings since the year 2000. And we did that a few months ago, and we've been looking at it since.
So you're still right now mining all of that, as they say.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of what data is available, there is a Colorado Open Records Act, which is CORA. And that says that in the spirit of open government, CORA requires that most public records be available to the public, and anyone can request information that's in the possession of a government office, including the Secretary of State's office. However, not all data is equal in terms of how it's presented. And this has been an issue we have talked about on KGNU with other folks who are involved in data access. Sometimes you make a request, sometimes you're given data in a form that's really inaccessible. So instead of a spreadsheet that you could maybe easily search, it might be photocopied pieces of paper that you have to manually go through. It might be PDFs that really aren't searchable. I mean, talk about some of the challenges. Once you make the request, you might get the data, but it doesn't stop there.
Yeah, as a data scientist, one of the biggest pet peeves I have with doing records requests is text data is actually really useful and analyzable. And I think Jonathan can speak a lot to that as well. But from the perspective of government agencies receiving records requests for things like emails, text is sort of just dead weight. It's not analyzable. And so a PDF is just as good of a format as anything in their minds. So Chu's not here today. She's founded the Denver Group, or helped found the Denver Group. And one of the things that we've been sort of working on broadly in the Denver Boulder area is like the anti-fracking movement. And one of the sort of projects with a local activist group is holding our local county officials accountable to sort of the interactions they have with the oil and gas industry. Because as we know, the moratorium in Boulder County has ended, and we have these three commissioners, and we would like to know sort of the exact details of their interactions with the oil and gas industry, because there's evidence that Elise Jones, for example, has met with Anadarko a few times during the moratorium. So we sent a records request in to the county for the emails, and we got back the response that they would take 40 hours to process all of the emails, and they would need to give it as a PDF, and it would cost me $1,400. So, you know, I think that's prohibitive to anyone except a news organization, and it sort of bars citizen journalists from doing this kind of work.
Well, Jonathan, what are your thoughts on that? On a national scope, when you are requesting data that should be available from government agencies, the format that it's given in and some of the barriers that are put up that prevent organizations like yourselves from actually accessing it.
I think Sam makes some really great points there. It's true the format itself is sometimes problematic. The speed or the timing with which data is available is problematic. And just the means for requesting data, before the open data movement even started, and there was just an expectation that people could retrieve public data from their government if it were useful to them, or if they wanted it. Frankly, it doesn't even need to be useful. There was the national project inside the community where some data scientists took it upon themselves to get sort of district-by-district voter history for the past 20 years from all of the states across the U.S., which seems like it should be a fairly straightforward process. That's public information. It's broadcast on the news in real time as elections are taking place. But in fact, that's a really difficult process. The procedure for requesting that type of voter information is different from state to state to state. And so sometimes there's a form that you can fill out online. Sometimes you actually have to make a phone call or even send a fax to the Secretary of State's office in that given state. And then the way in which they return that data to you is also different. Sometimes you get something in a format that's very useful for data analysis, but then other times, like Sam mentioned, you get a PDF with some written text and then maybe some data tables kind of spread or sifted throughout the document. Sometimes they want to send it to you in a paper format, like you mentioned as you were kind of introducing the topic. And so not only do they have to go through that on a state-by-state basis, where all of the data is a little bit messy and requires some cleaning, is just difficult and time-consuming to deal with, but then there's another problem. If you want to start to look at larger trends or explore more complex issues, often you need data from multiple sources that comes in multiple formats that needs to somehow be merged together under a in some sort of common format that you can use to look for patterns or pull out the kind of interesting information that's relevant to the question that you're trying to answer. So it's a really complex process. problem. I think as a society, frankly, we're still transitioning from an era where the assumption was that information was transmitted from human to human, and I would collect information by reading it, and we've transitioned to, well, we really expect machines to be able to read data, and that transition from human-readable to machine-readable as standard practice is something that I think we're still dealing with at the government level.
We're speaking about data, the role it plays in our democracy, particularly in the advent of an administration that uses words like alternative facts. And it seems that now more than ever, we need to have access to data. But is all data created equal? And then how do you access it? Well, that's the topic under discussion this morning on KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and my guests are with an organization, a volunteer group called Data for Democracy. It emerged in the wake of the Trump election. We have joining us by phone Jonathan Morgan, who's the co-founder of Data for Democracy. And in the studio, we have Sam Zhang, who is with the Boulder chapter of Data for Democracy. You gave out a shout out to Chu. So just to let our listeners know, Chu Liu is with the Denver chapter. She wasn't able to join us this morning. If she's listening, we'll give her a shout out and let you know that they're working on a lot of projects, including mapping demographic shifts and urbanization patterns in Denver. And they're partnering with some organizations like Colorado Black Women for Political Action and Colorado Black Health Collaborative, because those groups have found that through research of qualitative and community health information, that they're seeing that people of color are being pushed further away from healthcare. So this is one of the aspects of gentrification not necessarily being discussed. One of the projects being worked on by the Denver chapter for Data for Democracy. Also, they're trying to assess oil and gas impact in Colorado. And so that's another area that I know the Boulder chapter is also looking at. Before I invite listeners to call in, I'd like to go back to something that you brought up a little bit earlier, Jonathan, and this was the responsibility and how you personally felt as somebody working in the tech industry, a sense of responsibility to really look at how these tools are being used for better or for worse. That's something also Chu Liu also mentioned, that she has a personal sense of responsibility. And Sam, I think something you've mentioned as well. Aside from an individual level, what responsibility does the tech industry as a whole have to play in this? Jonathan Morgan, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the tech industry needs to accept that for better or for worse, whether or not this was their intention, that they are the stewards of public discourse. So our democracy is played out online, on social media platforms. That's where we talk with the other folks in our community, whether they live near us or whether they kind of share our ideology or whether they're friends and families who are now far flung, with whom, you know, we sometimes debate about the different issues that are important to the way that we want to govern our countries and our states and our cities. And so whether or not that's what they wanted, that's what they have. And I think whether or not that's what we would have wanted as a society, that's also what we have. So I think we need to, there's a lot of debate about whether Twitter and Facebook and Reddit have some sort of obligation to respect free speech, or whether they have an obligation to remove hate speech from their platforms, or whether they have an obligation to deal with automation and deception, and sort of what's their role to play. And I think I think it's an important question that they have to address head on. And I think it's also important that at the government level and as individuals, we lobby these organizations. Ultimately, they have a lot of power in this situation, whether or not we would have wanted it there. And I think that I think they do have a responsibility to make sure that they are, in fact, good stewards of public discourse, and that the way that our democracy functions that our democracy functions in a way that we're happy with, and ultimately they're big participants in that conversation, and I think that they should own it. Maybe instead of kicking the can down the road or pretending that that's a government problem, or come on, this is just an app for sharing photos of your babies or whatever. It's really not that. They're kind of crucial and central to it. I'd like to see them taking more responsibility in that regard.
They're also data aggregators themselves, and they're collecting and selling in many ways the data that they're collecting from the people who are using their platforms as well. I know Amazon and Facebook have been accused of all of that. I mean, mining all of the data that they're gathering from our purchases online, from what we, you know, like on Facebook, various different things like that. Sam, Jiang, do you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, and their financial incentives are totally not aligned with making the discourse more fair or open. I mean, Facebook, all these companies that Jonathan mentioned are for-profit companies, and they have a shareholder, you know, bottom line to meet. And so when Facebook is sending its amazing team of like world-class research scientists at these problems, the sort of things that are front and center for them are like, how do you keep people engaged? Essentially, how do you make the experience as addicting as possible? Which also weighs the most heavily on people who aren't, who are the most stressed and have, you know, mental disability and all of this and that, you know. And it's the same with like online games, like, you know, they often are unprofitable for the majority of people, but there's a minority of people who get wildly addicted and spend a lot of money. And they, you know, Zynga, there was like a thing where someone in the company called these people whales, you know, and it's just a totally derogatory relationship between the companies and the consumers. There's a really good group around here locally that sort of turned me onto this way of thinking about it, of like the company itself and the software they make is like the software, and the unthought of operating system underlying the software is the world of venture capital and, you know, Silicon Valley economics that drives their incentives. And this this person who's talking about it, Nathan Schneider, has, you know, a show on here about cooperatives, and he's writing a book about tech co-ops. And his argument is, if these companies are so central to our lives, why shouldn't they be publicly owned so that they can't externalize these negative effects that they're having on the community, but rather should be sustainable long term and, you know, actually give back to the people who put a lot of like work into them as well. Like Google hires an army of people to sift through inappropriate content. And from the reports I've read online, it's an extremely damaging job. You know, it's an emotionally distressing job. And I think these people should be given sort of like equity in Google the way that their software engineers are. But I don't think that's the case.
Nathan Schneider that you mentioned there, he's the host of Co-op Power Hour. It's broadcast on the fourth Thursday of every month, and it's The Economy at 6 o'clock here on KGNU. But this morning we're joined by two other guests, Sam Jiang, who we just heard from there. He's with the Boulder chapter of Data for Democracy. Joining us by phone, Jonathan Morgan, who's the co-founder of Data for Democracy, the national organization. It's now made up of lots and lots of local chapters who are using, you know, in many ways, data scientists who are volunteering to mine data to see how can we best use all of this information that's out there to better our democracy. And there are guests this morning on KGNU, Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. We do have some calls already coming in. We'll get to the phones in just a sec. But just to finish up this at this part of the conversation, is there a code of ethics that tech companies sign up to? Is this being discussed that there should be a code of ethics if one doesn't exist? Jonathan?
There is not, and I think that's it's being discussed actually as we speak. There's a group inside Data for Democracy that has taken it upon themselves to survey the community and talk to people who are actually practicing data science every day. What are the ethical challenges that you face? What are the kind of pressures that you're under that you lead you to navigating difficult ethical decisions, and how can we as a community come up with a code of conduct that would allow our industry in a grassroots way to make itself accountable? I think other highly technical professions have adopted kind of internal codes of conduct. The legal profession, the medical profession, I think data science and software engineering are no different. These are sort of highly skilled, knowledge-based professions that are difficult to understand from the outside. And so it really is on those individuals to kind of buy into what they want, how they want to practice their craft, and what the impact of their work is going to be. So I actually think we're probably, frankly, a little bit late in having this conversation, given the enormous impact that data and data science and big data is having in our society. But it is happening now, and I think that it'll be a big part of the discussion over the next, you know, probably over the next year, where a lot of this gets ironed out and some of these larger institutions decide whether they're going to participate and put their support behind what this community wants or whether they're going to challenge it. And we'll see how that plays out.
Well, we're going to invite listeners to call in. If you have a question or a comment, the number is 303-442-4242. And I'll invite our first caller, John, calling in from Boulder. You're live on KGNU. What's your question or comment this morning?
Thank you, Maeve. Really important discussion. I'd like to bring up sort of at the top of the list the use of automated plate readers. And those are devices that were really invented by Martin Marietta Corporation and a few others who perfected the reading of distant numerology and have used this primarily for war that went into Iraq and Afghanistan for identifying individuals and numbers, plates read from remote cameras via laser. And this is now a predominant thing used all over the United States by both police organizations, law enforcement, and it has been sold into the private areas of vehicle repossession and companies that want to keep track of vehicles. And it, looking at America as sort of a vehicle per person identity, probably, you know, more vehicles in the world per person than any other country in the world. Vehicles are, in fact, a very good way of keeping track of somebody's whereabouts and their habits. And these plate readers are automated. So they drive around and they literally, over the course of one day in the United States, millions and millions of plates are read, both by law enforcement and private companies. I want to hear a discussion on the access to these databases, how easy it is to obtain this information. I'd also like to point out that the laws that have been quietly being enacted in countries like Japan, the conspiracy law, which I urge everybody to get a hold of and read, it is an ominous, ominous law for a, quote, you know, free nation, allegedly a democracy. Also, the use of very intrusive surveillance by GCHQ in Britain, which has very few privacy laws that are akin to what we have in the United States, and also the Australians that have recently enacted laws. So these are crucial because these are components of the Five Eyes intelligence organization that shares intelligence between the United States, Canada, Britain, New Zealand, and Australia. This is very, very ominous for many, many reasons. I'd like to point out a recent article that came out that was part released by Snowden and other work by people in Australia showing the Alice Springs, Australia, the Joint Space Defense Facility in Australia, Alice Springs, a heavily U.S.-backed facility being absolutely crucial to pinpointing individual EINs in cell phones for targeting. So that would mean that satellites could actually pinpoint your location regardless of your terrestrial triangulation by cell towers. They could pinpoint your location from space and have been using this facility crucially for targeting individuals for elimination through drone attacks simply by identifying the telephone. They don't even know if the user is the intended target, but the telephone number is actually the targeting device. I'll let you guys discuss this and get off the air.
Okay, John, you bring up a lot of very interesting points there, a lot of food for thought. Samjang, you wanted to weigh in.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, thanks for bringing all of that up, John. There are two related thoughts that I just want to add on to your list of ideas. One is in China right now, they're deploying exactly like what you described, the license plate reading software, except they're reading faces. And in public spaces, they'll have a database of known criminals or people that they're interested in, and they'll scan every face walking through the plaza. At least that's what I read on The Intercept recently, so I haven't looked too much into it beyond that. You know, these technologies sort of come about in the private sector. They often percolate over, or they come about through military research like you described. And it's always sort of the end user who decides how it ultimately gets applied. Like, there's a huge range of ethical possibilities for something like facial recognition or for, you know, any sort of computer vision technology, like their self-driving cars, possibly. But there's also police scanning citizenry. And also now the thing about EIN and surveillance is one of the most nefarious applications of this sort of technology these days is how it gets used domestically on otherwise peaceful protesters, like at Standing Rock, like the expose about Tiger Swan, the private security company that came out of like that basically doing special forces operations in the army, have used the same techniques more or less. That it was found that they weren't even authorized to be performing security work out in North Dakota at one point, but you know, they're doing it anyway, and they're doing stuff like sniffing citizens' EIN numbers from their cell phones.
This seems to really go back to what we were talking about just before John's call about the ethics of all of this, and the fact that the technology is out there and it's being used, and a lot of data is being aggregated and compiled and held by different organizations, some of them for-profit organizations like the big tech companies and other governmental organizations. And then who gets to have access to them and how is it used? That seems to be, I suppose, the philosophical question underlying all of this. Jonathan Morgan, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think Sam framed it really well. And I think at the end of the day, whether we're talking about data and its implications or whether we're talking about a specific technology, these are effectively tools. And there's always a trade-off between, I think in the context of this conversation, utility, something that we'd all be excited about, like, well, something that I think a lot of folks would be excited about, like a self-driving car or a license plate reader that grabs your plates as you go through a toll booth so you don't have to stop and you get to your destination faster. Maybe it's less expensive. But then, of course, there are that sort of utility butts right up against privacy concerns, and then also some reasonable security concerns, whether that's kind of local police or national security. Some of the computer vision stuff we've been talking about, I know, was used in the past to identify people who were who might be at risk to police stations in Mosul when Iraq was being rebuilt the first time after, you know, one of our many invasions. But in any case, it was a scenario where there was a real risk, a real security risk to real people who were just trying to get their jobs done. And being able to use some of these tools and technologies to identify people who were potentially threatening was, I think, a justifiable use of those tools. But at the end of the day, it's us as citizens who need to make this determination. And I think that it's not something that we should leave in the hands of technology companies. And frankly, it's not something that we should leave in the hands of government, because technology companies, like Sam pointed out, have motives that aren't necessarily aligned with public good. Maybe they will, but ultimately they're focused on ensuring that they continue to make a profit. And I think that these technologies evolve too quickly for governments to understand. And so I think as a society, as individual citizens, we need to decide where our line is, how we want to negotiate that balance between utility, security, and privacy. And then we need to make our voices heard. So whether it's sort of using our wallets and impacting the bottom line of companies that don't respect our values, and using our voice at the ballot box and making sure that we're putting legislators in office who will respect our values and do their best to write legislation that is consistent with the way that we want these technologies and tools to operate. How can we sort of codify our ethics around these really difficult questions? And I think I think that's the practical outcome of this, is that we need to decide where our lines are when we're thinking about the way that these tools are used.
We have about 20 minutes left with our guests, Jonathan Morgan and Sam Zhang, with Data for Democracy here on KGNU. If you would like to join the conversation, or maybe you might have an idea of a project that could be very useful locally if we have some volunteer data scientists who'd like to mine some information, you can give us a call at 303-442-4242. We spoke about some of the projects you're involved in, Sam, here in Boulder, and we gave a shout out to the Denver chapter and what they're doing as well. Jonathan, can you give us some examples of national projects by Data for Democracy volunteers that is actually impacting either policy or, you know, community discourse or around some of the information that they're unearthing?
Absolutely. There's really a lot of fantastic projects. that are happening inside the community, both at a national and even recently at an international level. There's a, in particular, if we're talking about projects that are focused on improving public discourse, there's a core group of volunteers who've really taken it on themselves to understand the mechanics of manipulation, of social media manipulation. And so they've developed techniques for understanding automation, identifying bots, sort of watching these sort of propaganda campaigns as they're orchestrated in real time, kind of moving from one community on the internet into more public spaces like Twitter and Facebook. And then I think even beyond that, they've started to make, I think, very clear-minded recommendations for how tech companies can participate, or sort of what their role is in facilitating this conversation. There's a volunteer called Chris Schaefer, who in particular, I think, has some really smart ideas about the way that these larger tech platforms can use their leverage as sort of the primary, the advertising platforms, the way in which content is monetized. And so ultimately, if a hate group operating a website full of hate speech, like the Daily Stormer, which has been in the news a lot recently, ultimately the way that sites like that are able to make money is by using the same tools as everybody else who produces content on the internet. They're able to advertise using Facebook ads or Google ads, and that generates revenue that allows these sites to function. And so in a way, Facebook and Google are allowing that, they're kind of enabling that content to persist. And so I think he's done some really smart work around just making sure that that's well understood by the public, that there's some transparency around the fact that ultimately everybody who puts content on the internet is empowered by technology providers who help them build their tools, distribute their content, and ultimately make money off of it. And so everybody in that chain has some level of accountability for the content that's produced and the consequences of it. So I think that's been one where focused specifically on this type of, you know, the sort of degrading quality of public discourse, and I think they've made some strong suggestions for how to improve it.
Sam, we spoke several weeks ago, and you said there are lots of opportunities and the huge potential for this. And you mentioned the oil and gas industry, and it seems that that is an area, as we are having policy discussions now at a county level and at a state level, that if you had data that you could really make a difference in that. And you had talked about maybe trying to mine some of the information about complaints that were made to the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission or some of the other agencies. And talk a little bit about some of the potential that's out there. And what are some of the barriers in terms of what data is not being collected that should be collected that would really make a difference to the community if they had access to it?
Yeah. I mean, one of the really interesting things about data in the policy area around oil and gas in particular is, as far as I'm concerned, more data isn't
the solution.
The solution. It's not, the problem isn't that we don't have enough data about climate change. Like, the science is clear. Like, we can't have any new fossil fuel infrastructure if we're even going to meet the meager agreements in the Paris Climate Accords. And yet, you know, Hickenlooper is, we're on a nonstop train constructing oil and gas development, even here in Boulder County. So I think a lot of the data work in this area, it's, you know, it's, I don't know what the word for it is. It's not quite essential, it feels. It's like it's supplementary to the political work that goes on, and it always gives us more legitimacy to have, like, the correct figures and facts. And often that's used sort of as the way to attack activists. It's like, oh, you don't even know the science. So, you know, we're just here to sort of make that part a little bit stronger. But I don't think that the movement is made or broken by data in this particular case. And as for data that we wish we had, I mean, everyone who has been drilled, like, I've been talking to the farmers at the farmers market, and some of them are in Weld County, which, you know, is the most densely drilled oil field in the country. A lot of them wish that they had collected soil samples and groundwater samples before the drilling came in, because now, you know, they aren't able to make a scientific case that they have been directly impacted, which I think is, you know, it's absurd in its own way, but I, you know, there are different thresholds of evidence for different fields. And
Well, you bring up a good point. There is a lot of science out there, but it's being ignored in many ways. And so, you know, what use then is it when we have even more data analysis if it's just going to go the way of all the previous stuff that's getting ignored or denied?
Exactly. I think that goes to show this underlying, like I was saying earlier, the underlying operating system of finance underneath the world of data, and how important it is to recognize that and sort of attack the power structures directly and deal with them directly. You know, there's, I don't believe for a second that data in itself will solve all of our political problems. It's only power, you know, it's through actual political mobilization and community organizing and like actually equipping people who are trying to make change with the evidence that they need that we actually get change. So, you know, we're part of a team.
But I do see huge potential for, you know, the project that you're involved in really alerting communities to the impact of some of these big policy decisions in their communities, like with the racial profiling and looking at the police that you did, and then with the Denver chapter looking at the impacts of gentrification and to have concrete data there to say this is exactly what's happening here.
I have a good example of this at the local / national level. This project didn't start with Data for Democracy. They're just sort of friends of ours, and they came and gave a talk at our last meetup. But it's this group called the Catalyst Cooperative. It's a tech cooperative owned by four people who are active in the cooperative movement around here. Zane Selvins, Alana Christina, and Steve Winters. They have been mining this, it's like we discussed earlier, this federally available data that's in a terrible format. There's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the Energy Information Agency. And these two agencies, FERC and EIA, release regulatory disclosures from power plants. And through this data, we're able to back out a lot of information about which power plants could be retired because they're no longer efficient, especially coal plants. And these things make a huge policy difference, but they're not available in a way that's actually accessible. Like they were telling the story of how they came into this data. They just kept working with different nonprofits that kept asking for the same data over and over again. And when they attempted to sort of do it systematically, they found that the only place where one of the data sets was stored was in this proprietary database format that the company no longer even exists. So it took them a lot of work to sort of back it out.
Well, we have just about 10 minutes left and I'll go back to the phones and welcome Robert, who's calling in. You're live on KGNU. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. I'd like to ask about focus of data on nature, on understanding, appreciating, and protecting nature. Currently, it seems to me there's very little study or data or even interest in it for such things as development, extraction, and recreation. Maybe a few birds are studied, you know, a few rare species of plants might be looked for, but overall, water samples are not taken, soil samples are not taken, insects generally are not studied, amphibians are not studied, reptiles are generally not studied, even general bird populations and mammals, the studies are very limited, looking at only a few species or looking at only a few years of time rather than the longer cycles of things that occur in nature. And it seems it's a travesty to think that we can do all these things that we want to do in nature with so little study and say, oh, everything's okay. You know, we're not hurting anything. In fact, we're helping nature by doing these things. And I wonder what you could say about getting more data, more interest in data, in real study, more in-depth, holistic study of nature before we do these impacts of development, recreation, and extraction.
Thank you for your call, Robert. Great question. Sam, did you want to weigh in?
I think what you described, Robert, is very similar to the field of ecology and the sort of work of because when you're an ecologist, you're looking at the entire system and not just individual parts of the system. And one of the big travesties in our current scientific ecosystem right now, in my opinion, is the divorce between economics and the sort of ecologically influenced data analysis. Like, I have a friend who got a master's in ecological economics, where instead of externalizing, like we were talking earlier about the tech companies, instead of externalizing the damages to the community and allowing these statistical models to only account for the things that corporate interests care about, we actually incorporate things like you talked about, Robert, like damage to the environment in the models themselves. And it's obviously it's very complex.
And this reminds me of a discussion that happened earlier this morning on Democracy Now! About if fossil fuels were priced correctly, that had all of those externalized costs to the environment, to communities, to public health actually reflected in the cost of fossil fuels, it would not make any economic sense. And you could get all the Republicans on board to stop what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. Robert, thank you very much for your call.
Oh, can I say one last thing?
Please, go ahead.
The old business model, it would be good to apply to all that we do, and that's the cost-benefit risk analysis. And if we really start looking at all the costs, all the benefits, and all the risks, we'll be much wiser and smarter in what we do in every facet of our lives. And I would say that particularly these days, risk is kind of off the table in business and environmental concerns. It doesn't hardly even register as to what risk there might be, mm-hmm. or likely will be in what we do.
Go
Thank
ahead.
You.
Thank you, Robert. Sam?
I think you're making an argument, Robert, very similar to, or at least in the same spirit as this writer whose essays I read recently. Her name is Nancy Fraser, and she's, I think, a sociologist or political theorist. And she's talking about the way that capitalism has treated social reproduction, which is sort of like the fabric of our community, our interpersonal relationships, the same way that it's treated the environment, which is as an unlimited resource that production can draw from and deplete infinitely. And as we know, that's not true. Our environment is falling apart. We have climate change and natural disasters. And we have these communities that are getting strained to the limit because people are working two or three jobs and they don't have the capacity to maintain those social reproductive bonds that keep democracy alive. And to me, that's sort of at the core of why I'm doing this sort of work as well. Like, we're, by being volunteers doing the civic duty, we're helping strengthen the social reproductive fabric of our communities.
Well, thank you for your call, Robert. We just have just under 5 minutes left this morning with Sam Zhang and Jonathan Morgan of Data for Democracy. Sam is with the Boulder chapter. Jonathan is the co-founder of the national organization. What's the potential for all of this? Because it seems that you can mine and analyze all of this data, but then you need to get that information out to the public. And so maybe partnering with some of those social media platforms or with local media organizations. I mean, where does this go next? Jonathan Morgan.
I think you're absolutely right. There's two areas where I see this going next. One is that we'd love to have as many people involved as possible. So whether you think of yourself as a technologist, whether you think of yourself as a data scientist, or whether you think you're just interested in technology and you'd like to see your community improve, there's a place for you. We'll find a way to get you plugged in either to one of these local chapters or some of the work that's going on nationally. So I think ultimately, the stronger our communities are and the more people who are involved and the more people who have a stake in the outcome, the better off we'll be and the better our chances are for making real change. Ultimately, it takes a lot of us, right, to make a real change in how our communities work. And I think second to that, there are some institutions that are sort of already, you know, mission aligned, we might say, with where we want to go, whether these are nonprofit organizations that are already working in communities that have a strong voice and have a lot of influence, whether they're civic institutions, sort of city and state governments. And I think that partnering with institutions like that means that we can, A, focus our volunteer efforts on the right problems, the problems that have the most impact that have already been identified by experts who are, like Sam was saying, advocating for the kinds of change that we want to see and making sure that we're supporting those folks with the facts and figures that they need. And then also can take the discoveries that we make and make sure that they're seen by the right folks, our sort of discussed in the right conversations. Ultimately, I think those two things are how are sort of where we take this next and continue to grow this movement.
And people can find out more at the website, datafordemocracy.org. We'll link to that at kgnu.org. There's a map that shows where there are chapters, and there seems that there are chapters a lot in the US, many in Europe and Australia, India, and a lot of different places. Samjang, how can people locally get involved in either one of the existing chapters? There's one in Boulder, one in Denver, or if they wanted to create their own.
We have a meetup group locally that anyone interested should join. It's at meetup.com/ I think it's data-for-democracy-boulder. I'll make sure that's right and get it to you, Maeve.
And we'll put it online. Cool. And then do you have physical meetups? Because I know a lot of this is happening virtually and people are communicating online.
Most of our communication is online, and we've just started using these meetup.com meetups. And already at our first meetup, we had over 20 people show up, and a woman drove up from Colorado Springs because she said it was within 2 miles of her. So clearly there's a thirst for this kind of work. And I encourage people to start one, you know, in Colorado Springs if you're listening from there. But otherwise, you know, you can come to ours.
And what skills do you need? Because I know a lot of you are data scientists and you have a lot of tech background. But are there other skills that could be put to good use as part of this organization?
Curiosity really helps. We're trying to start from a place of not very many assumptions on what people come to the table with. But a passion and a desire to learn. If you already have data analysis skills, great. That's wonderful. And if you're already like a community stakeholder and involved with a project that you want some help with, like, perfect. Like, you're sort of the target audience. But, you know, we'll just talk about these things. And I think learning is sort of a collaborative process. And I think you could pick up a lot just by sitting in the room.
Well, I'd like to thank both my guests this morning. Jonathan Morgan joined us by phone. He's the co-founder of Data for Democracy, and that was founded in the wake of the Trump election, but it is now being used by communities really around the world to use data in a positive way and find out how it can best be used for communities. Joining us in the studio, we had Samjang with the Boulder chapter of Data for Democracy. We'll put links to the organizations at kgnu.org if people would like to find out more or get involved. Jonathan, Sam, thank you very much.
Thanks, Maeve.